Over the last few years, there's been growing concern about excessive use of force by police around the country, especially in communities with high proportions of people of color. The high-profile deaths of Michael Brown, Eric Garner, and others have led to calls for more accountability from police when they use force.
In Wisconsin, after the death of unarmed 19-year-old Tony Robinson in Madison, Dane County community organizations and law enforcement officials came together to create the Special Community Police Task Force to try to reduce incidents of police force and rebuild community trust. That task force has released its first report now, looking exclusively at use of force.
Joining us to talk about that task force and the new guidelines that they're recommending to law enforcement agencies is Sue Reisling. She's the chief of the University of Wisconsin-Madison Police Department and is on the Special Community Police Task Force, which has created new use of force guidelines for police departments. Chief Reisling, welcome back.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Well, tell us a little bit about the genesis of this task force. How did it first come about?
Well, I approached the United Way and asked them to bring together some leaders in law enforcement and also leaders in communities of color right after the Ferguson incident. So we started meeting in September, October of 2014. And we met for month after month, had very good and meaningful conversations. And then came the death of Tony Robinson. And when that happened, we decided as a group we needed to actually put together something that would be very tangible and an actual product that would hopefully make change in the way that we address our community concerns around police use of force. And so I was asked to chair a task force to look at the use of force here in Dane County, and I co-chaired that with Reverend Everett Mitchell, who is a leading pastor here in the Madison area. And then we had a vice chairman, Reuben Anthony, who's the president of the Urban League.
And so not just law enforcement here tackling this one on its own, but bringing in people from across different communities, different spectrums. How did that conversation first start to unfold? Because this was a highly pressurized time, both nationally and after the death of Tony Robinson here in Dane County.
Well, there were 13 members on the task force itself, and four of them were from law enforcement and the rest were from the community. And so we did come together. And, you know, at first, the important thing we felt was to ensure that everyone understood the law. And so we had experts come in on the law and talk to us about the law surrounding police use of force. And then we had experts come in that talked about training and then the equipment that's used, the policies. We had people come in from the state that sets the training guidelines and standards. And we really spent the first several months learning from the experts. And so the community had a good opportunity to talk to those experts, ask them questions directly. From there, we started really conversations about how does the expertise blend with a community standard. And from there, we began really to have very interesting discussions and give our various perspectives on police use of force, but also on community relations and also on the stress that police officers do face day in and day out, call to call. And so from that, we started to form recommendations, and now we've got this report that has 60 recommendations in it. So it's a quite voluminous piece of work.
You use the phrase community standard there. What do you mean by that?
Well, everybody understands that there's a legal standard. And I think most folks would understand then that what comes off of the legal standard are a series of tactical standards. How do we actually make decisions, and how do we move through the use of equipment and so forth that we have? But then there's a whole other area that I think we don't spend as much time on in law enforcement, and that is, what is the community standard? What's the community expectation? And so Madison, Wisconsin, you know, is a special place. Dane County, Wisconsin is kind of a special place where our population is much more highly engaged than many places around the country. And as a result, they want to have a voice and a say in how the law and the tactics actually get put to use on the street by police officers. And so what are the community expectations? And what is that going to lead to?
And just briefly, and we'll get into the recommendations a little bit later, but first of all, why did you choose to begin with use of force?
Well, there were three things that the collaboration thought were important: use of force, implicit bias, and diversifying police agencies within Dane County. And we started with use of force mainly because it's the big elephant in the room, and it was right after the death of Tony Robinson.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're continuing our conversation now with Susan Reisling. She's the chief of the University of Wisconsin-Madison Police Department, and she chaired the Special Community Police Task Force, which has created new use of force guidelines for police departments. And Chief Reisling, we left off looking at the big picture. Now let's get into the specifics a bit. Tell us about some of the first of these guidelines to emerge.
Well, one of the things that we talked a lot about was changing some key policing practices so that we hopefully would reduce use of force. So, for instance, we are very proficient in the use of the weaponry that we have to carry, and we're held accountable for that. What we want to do is make sure that police officers are equally as proficient in using de-escalation tactics as using weapons. And so we've started to build on that with the idea of crisis intervention training, which focuses on the mentally ill. It's quite an extensive course and helps police officers understand how sometimes just movements that they would normally make are actually, you know, exasperating the situation. And so how to bring that, how to bring everything down, how to de-escalate the tension, how to deal with people with mental illness, people who are emotionally disturbed, and quite frankly, just the everyday citizen who is having a police encounter, which is not exactly the highlight of their day, and ensure that we're doing everything we can to lower the tension as much as possible.
And I imagine that that affects the training that police officers get, and especially maybe new recruits.
Oh, absolutely. And it's a change of psychology and focus a little bit. And that's really the big shift. So, for instance, people go to the range all the time, and we're expecting to go to the range. We're expecting to shoot our weapons. And so many of the targets that we shoot at are threatening targets. There's somebody there with a gun in their hand. There's somebody there, you know, with a rifle or whatever. And what we're doing now, obviously, is intermixing a lot of those targets with people who have cell phones so that you don't your immediate reaction is not always to shoot, but to make sure that you know exactly what you're shooting at, exactly what's in that person's hand, and whether or not it poses a threat. Now, we've always done training like that, but I think the focus now is much more on ensuring that we are using every bit of the tools and training before we get to the use of force.
And body cameras have mm-hmm. been a big subject in police departments across the country. How will that move forward in Dane County now with these new guidelines?
Well, actually, we really haven't put together guidelines. These are more recommendations. So as a result, what we're suggesting, the task force felt very strongly that the use of cameras is helping the discussion and helping hold police and the community accountable for what's going on the streets. But what we want to see is that departments that don't use them, that they're making sure that their communities are part of that dialogue, either to use them or not use them. So at the university, we did this a year or so ago, and we started to use the cameras, body-worn cameras, in October of 2015. The City of Madison, Dane County Sheriff's Department, I know they have groups that are studying whether or not they should use them. Other departments in Dane County do use body cameras, and then, you know, some others have chosen not to.
Now, looking at sort of the situation where things can go wrong between police and the person they're working with. Also, sometimes the focus has been on communities of color. There's been a trust gap that has emerged. How will that be addressed with these new recommendations?
Well, you know, one of the things that we talk about quite a bit, and it's the third big recommendation out of this task force, is the idea of engaging the community. And one of the interesting things that bubbled up was the community members on this task force talked about the fact that the public needs some greater awareness about how police are trained and also how police are going to act and react. And the public needs to understand that when they make certain moves or don't necessarily listen to what the police are saying when the police are in kind of a command mode, that how that can accelerate and move down the continuum toward the use of force. And so the community members were talking about the fact that the community groups could come together and do some educating of different, whether it's different church groups or different public groups or different community groups, that the actual leaders of the community groups could come together and help out with doing some of that training and just building awareness. And through that awareness comes a trust, because then you understand what the other side is thinking.
I know that you've also focused on the well-being of police? Because this is I guess it's just a stressful time for a lot of people involved. How will this focus on that aspect?
One of the big surprises to me from this task force was the community. About midway through our process, the community members turned and said, "Wow, this is an incredibly stressful job. What are we doing to ensure that police stress is managed? And what are we doing to ensure that police officers are well and have a wellness focus?" That was kind of a surprise to me, how much the community members on the group really thought really important. And so what we're looking at is asking each department in Dane County to develop wellness programs within their organization. The University Police, we've had a wellness program for several years now, and it focuses not only physical wellness and nutrition, we put on cooking classes for the police, but also financial wellness and spiritual wellness. And so we've actually had financial planners, and we've ensured kind of a holistic look, too. And there's a program called Wills for Heroes, and making sure that everybody has a will, so that if they have family, the family will be taken care of if something, you know, terrible were to happen to them. So making sure that we're taking care of the whole, and that was really important to the community members, that we think through the police and how difficult the job is, and that we deal with police stress in an affirmative, proactive way.
And Chief Risling, as we wrap up, what do you expect to be the next steps with these recommendations?
Well, most all of the county departments within Dane County, all the police departments within Dane County have signed on to this report and have signed on to looking at these recommendations and attempting to implement as many of these as they can within their home jurisdictions. And I think the next step is we check in 6 months and see where we are.
Well, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Susan Risling, chief of the UW-Madison Police Department. She joined us to talk about new use of force guidelines and recommendations for Dane County Police Departments.
Jump in the line, rock your body on time. Okay, I believe you jump in the line.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Harry Belafonte sure makes jumping in line sound like a lot of fun, but by and large, being stuck in a line is seen as a nuisance, an annoyance, a necessary evil.
From lines at grocery stores, tourist traps, restaurants, to stop and go traffic, to waiting on hold on the phone, a lot of us just take lining up for granted. But not our next guest. In his new book, he looks into the psychology, the history, and the mathematics behind those lines, and he finds a lot of surprises along the way.
David Andrews joins us now. He's the author of the book, Why Does the Other Line Always Move Faster? The Myths and Misery, Secrets and Psychology of Standing in Line. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Well, it seems like the line is something that I take for granted. Most people do, but not you. What is it that got you thinking so much and studying so much to find out what makes lines work?
Well, there's a few things. There was a fact that I grew up largely overseas in what was used to be behind the Iron Curtain in Romania. So, you know, famous for its long lines. And later on, I also went into boot camp. And the big surprise for me with boot camp was that it wasn't this action-packed adventure, but it was just a lot of just standing and staring at the back of the head of the person in front of you. Hours of every day would be spent doing this.
Now, I think I assume that lines are just kind of a natural thing. It's an obvious way we're wired to stand in line and wait for something. But you say, no, this is actually a pretty modern invention. So where did the modern line first come from?
Well, this is the most surprising thing to me when researching this book, was the fact that there wasn't even a concept of the line until about 1840, and it was the great English writer Thomas Carlyle who was describing the French Revolution. He looked across the channel and had these rapturous words for what he witnessed them doing over there, which is standing en queue, and queue means tail in French. So they're standing in the form of a tail, and he thought this was this miraculous thing that they were doing. And even up to the mid-century, 1850s, 1860s, you still have, like, American tourists coming over to France and marveling at this quaint little thing that they were doing. And then sometime around the end of the century, that's when people started complaining already that everybody's now standing in line and life is drained of excitement.
Well, and the problem was that this solved, I guess, you're right, was things were a little too exciting as we had bigger and bigger cities and too many people. And it sounds like it was just a mad rush to get from one place to the next. And no, it was just chaos.
Yeah, the story of how we came to be inveterate line standers is very much the story of how we started living in cities. There's accounts of, for instance, in London, of just how chaotic this. This is the biggest city in the world, and people are constantly pushing. There's crowds would rise up and sometimes riot. And at some point, you know, there's a lot of city planners who started thinking, hey, maybe there's something that we can do about this. So they started making, you know, gridded streets and having, you know, inventing queue barriers at the bank, you know, the velvet rope, and finding ways to basically direct traffic, foot traffic, that is.
And speaking of planning, you write that the place that really has advanced the science of lines to an art in some ways is Disney World. A part of it is making lines actually shorter and faster. We'll get to that. But part of it is making line feel more pleasant, even if it's just as long. So how does a line become less annoying?
Well, this is the, you know, people have been researching this for a couple of decades now about, you know, how to decrease the length of the line. But then two people in particular, Dr. Richard Larson at MIT and David Meister at Harvard, were both writing about, well, part of the problem is not the length of the lines, it's how people feel in lines. And so how can we distract them from the fact that they're waiting? And so Disney has really mastered the art of basically distracting people from the fact that they're waiting. So if you go into a Disney line, there would be lots of entertainment in the line itself, and they if the lines are too long, they'll send some Mickey Mouse dressed person to go entertain the children, or they'll do subtle things like they'll tell you how much time you can expect to wait in line, which will be slightly inflated so that when you get through the line quicker than you thought you were going to, you just feel better about the whole experience. And there's a lot of different things that go into how Disney itself, you know, they put so much thought into how their lines work. And Walt Disney himself would, you know, test them out, you know, walk amongst the crowds and see how the lines work.
And yeah, you found a surprising amount of research, not just going into Disney, but into economics of lines and engineering of lines and the mathematics of lines. People really have studied this, and it actually has an economic payoff for Disney, for phone companies, for the internet, too.
Yeah, so there's a branch of science called Q-theory now, and it rose back when telephones were a fairly new thing. It was developed over in the Netherlands. And, you know, this is back in the days of switchboard operators, and, you know, something would happen, and everybody would try and call it once, and the lines would just get hopelessly jammed. And so the telephone company decided that, well, we need to find a way to study when it's going to be likelier that there's going to be huge swells of crowds using the phones. And so they developed the science largely involving statistics and, past models of human behavior to be able to know how many switchboard operators to have on have in the workplace on a given day, on a given hour in a given day.
We're talking to David Andrews. His new book is called Why Does the Other Line Always Move Faster? Well, you write that, David, that the TV show that best captures the spirit of standing was Seinfeld. Jerry and his friends wait in line for movies, restaurants, and this is a couple decades back. Here's George waiting in line for a payphone.
The point is, I was here first.
Well, if you were here first, you'd be holding the phone.
You know, we're living in a society. We're supposed to act in a civilized way.
So how did Seinfeld capture lines so well?
Well, I suspect. Well, here's what it's a show about. You know, they're famously a show about nothing. There's so much interaction in the show happens in line, and so many episodes involve kind of the ethics of who comes. You know, first come, first serve, and you know, the famously amoral characters who try to winnow their way to the front of a given line. But and there's plenty of episodes. There's at least two or three that I can think of episodes in which, you know, the whole episode is framed around them waiting for something. So there's the famous Chinese restaurant episode that just involves them waiting to get a table. And oftentimes there it ends without them getting what they came to get. So the episode ends without it. So it has kind of a very Kafka-like process where the protagonist never gets to his goal because of the wait in line.
And this tells us a lot, I think, about our psychology and about a civilization and society, as George Costanza was saying. You write about one piece of research, I think in England it was, where the grad students were supposed to intentionally cut into line and see what happened. And the students had a really hard time. They felt almost literally sick cutting into line.
Yeah, don't give the British too much credit. That was actually Stanley Milgram, famous social psychologist. And he and his grad students, yeah, they basically tested to see whether people would actually let them cut in line. Mm-hmm. And it was surprising on two counts, which is most of the time people didn't think it was worth it to call them out on it. The second biggest surprise, as you said, is just how psychologically wrenching it was, how deeply internalized this first come first serve ideal was inside of them. So, you know, sweaty palms and just feeling really guilty and nervous.
Well, another weird contradiction of lines, I think, is, you know, you think Eastern Europe, or even you give an example in Britain, I think, mid-20th century, you see lots of long lines. That's a sign of failure, that we've gotten something wrong. We don't have enough supply to meet demand or something like that. On the other hand, if my restaurant has lines going out the door, it's a big success. It's a hit. And you even write that in some cases, restaurants in Japan pay people to wait outside their door to generate buzz. So lines really have this double-edged meaning to us.
Yeah, and, you know, we say we're standing in line as if it's one thing, but it has different social practices for different reasons. And there's definitely the practice of, like, hype. You know, there's these lines, or, you know, for people waiting in line for weeks for Star Wars tickets, for instance. There's lots of instances where people will, you know, get in line to be seen in line, to go there with their friends, and it's a social experience that is part of the validation of having that product.
But in Eastern Europe, it was, you stood in line in the communist era because you had to get things there, but then the government would try to sell, oh no, this is a sign of solidarity, this is a sign of our equality.
Yeah, I mean, in a lot of places, I mean, the same thing happened in England during the World War II, when there's lots of rationing, and there's this kind of dual kind of feeling about standing in line, where yes, there's this, we're all doing our part, we're all waiting our turn, but then there's that other part where it's like, but this is failure, this is something that was wrong, and people's emotions hinge upon, for instance, how long they've been standing in line. So, you know, 15 minutes, I feel a lot of solidarity with everybody else, and then 3 hours later, that mood sours. And you see the same thing when Thomas Carlyle was writing about the French Revolution and the peasants who have to wait for bread lines, and the same thing happened there, where, you know, at first it was all about, you know, fraternity and solidarity, and then after people were much hungrier, it very much broke down.
So when we're waiting, say, at the checkout line at the grocery store in a lanes of, you know, bumper-to-bumper traffic, does the other line, David, always move faster, or does it just always feel like it?
Well, it mostly just feels like it. It's the grass is greener on the other side. The point of the title is that our minds are not terribly good at objectively measuring things, including time, when we're kind of caught. It's kind of a line standing feels like a kind of punishment somehow, the same way that, you know, toddlers are given time out or something. And so, yes, you always, I tend to at least, always project that the other line is moving faster. It may or may not on a given basis, but my mind certainly overplays my own misery in that situation.
We'll leave it there. David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you so much.
That was David Andrews. He's the author of the book, Why Does the Other Line Always Move Faster? The Myths and Misery, Secrets and Psychology of Standing in Line.